please join me in welcoming Bank of America's Chairman and CEO, Brian Moynihan.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Dick, for inviting me. And I want to recognize all my teammates here today. You know, you all know Jerry, and she does a great job versus the market, but she knows, and I know, that we wouldn't be anything without our teammates here. So could they raise their hands, stand up or something, all the teammates of Bank of America? It's great to have many clients with us today, and I appreciate to share the opportunity. It's nice to see Ken. He's aging in reverse, so I guess there's something about not having the stress of running a big company. But Ken, you obviously rescued me from a different company and gave me opportunities that allowed me to do what I do today. So thank you, Ken, for joining us today. We also have a couple of my current bosses here today, Lionel Noel and Tom Woods, who are two of our directors. So if you don't like what I say, talk to them. It's nice to see the high school students here, and thank you for all you do to build yourselves and your careers and your civic accomplishments. We all sat at the table and said none of us did that in high school, so thank you and congratulations. Keep us in mind when you're ready to go to work. What I thought I'd do is start with a few core facts. Naples and Florida are tremendously important markets for our company. We've been here for a long time, as you all know. We have 500 employees in Fort Myers in Southwest Florida here. Three Merrill Lynch offices, two U.S. trust offices, 39 financial centers, and it's a great, great market for us. We've made almost $1 billion of loans to businesses in this market, so we support the businesses that help make this market what it is. Across Florida, we have almost 550 financial centers and 19,000 teammates work in the state for Bank of America, so it's a tremendous, important part of our company. I'm going to hit three topics, and I'm going to leave lots of time for questions, and I'm told that you're not shy. Long speeches over lunch are one of the things that CEOs like to do, not as much as they like to answer questions and have a good engaged conversation. So we'll hit a few topics, and hopefully we'll get to what you are interested in. First is, how are we doing at Bank of America, and more importantly, how we're doing it? We're a large company. We serve 47 million American households today, nearly one in two. We have thousands of businesses here and around the world. It's an honor we all take extremely seriously, and so as you all should be clients, if you're not, the teammates will sign you up after lunch. From the sounds of a lot of the questions I got walking around, you're all shareholders and you want to know about dividends, so we'll give you a state-of-the-state approach and talk about what we're doing in the company. So that's topic one. Second is the view of the economy, both from our industry-leading research team and from what we see with our clients and customers. And third, I thought, and I know that you had a fellow from Bitcoin here a few weeks ago or in the recent past, but I talk about the core technology trends that we see in our company and that we see in banking and how they're affecting us, importantly, how we think they go in the future. So the first question, how are we doing and are we doing okay? Sure, we're doing very well as a company. In 2017, taking out the tax hit we had to take to write down tax assets in the fourth quarter, we earned $21 billion after tax, basically on par with the highest earnings year we had in 2006. Our market capitalization for banks is third largest in the world. We're the 12th largest market cap of all companies in the world. We earned as much as six companies in the world. And we earned all but what four companies earn in the U.S. So the company's doing very well. The customer scores are at all-time highs. Our teammates come to work every day to live the purpose, to help make your lives better as our customers and clients. Capital, liquidity, the balance sheet is in a fortress status. We grew our core loans. We have tremendous capacity to serve. We grew our core loans by $45 billion year-end to year-end last year. Our deposits grew by $50 billion. And last year, we did almost a $4.5 billion in community development work. We have 200,000 very talented teammates that work for us and enjoy strong benefits and great pay for performance and do a great job. We increased dividends from 7.5 cents to 12 cents a quarter, a 60% increase, and as Jerry said earlier, we basically returned almost $17 billion of capital. So we're doing pretty well, but the important thing is how we're doing it. We're doing it by driving a concept we call responsible growth. Responsible growth will serve us well, not only in the good times, but hopefully serve us very well in the tough times. It has four tenets. You have to grow and win in the market every day. That's the acid test. Your customers do more with you. That means you're successful. We have to do it on a customer-focused basis. Whereas Ken and his predecessors in our company had to worry about putting together this marvelous franchise, it's illegal for us to do transactions now. It has been for about 15 years, probably. We can't buy anything, so my life's easy. I just got to go out and operate. So it's all focused on customers and just doing organic growth. We have to grow within our risk appetite. What we do in the good times here will serve us well. And we have to grow on a sustainable basis. Sustainable has three core things. First, we have to be the best place for people to work. Second, we have to share our success with our communities. And third, we have to drive operational excellence. A little bit about being the best place for people to work. We have great pay for performance, other human resource policies, and development opportunities. Let me give you some examples. Our teammates, despite the narrative out there that wages aren't growing, our teammates at Bank of America, if they're in the bottom half of the teammates in terms of pay, have experienced three times the national average in growth in wages and salaries across the last 8-10 years. The healthcare costs were cut in half in 2010, and we've held them there for 8 years. Compensation across the board, even for the teammates above that, has grown at twice the national average. We've had $15 an hour as a starting minimum wage since last year, last February in 2017, a level our peers are only trying to get to. We extended family leave, bereavement, child care, robust dollar-for-dollar match in a 401k, and all that results from a business purpose, an all-time low turnover, and all-time high employee satisfaction. So that's the first tenet of being growing sustainably. The second tenet is how we serve and share success with our communities. You hear a lot of talk in the environment today about ESG, environmental, social, governance. It's a hot topic. You hear a lot of discussion out in the broad environment. We have investment strategies that invest against those principles. On the environmental side, our company has had a great legacy of working. We have an environmental program that we doubled 5 years ago to $125 billion, and we're halfway through that. On the social side, our team has given away $200 million per year in cash gifts. Examples in Collier County with $1.3 million in grants and matching gifts we've given the last few years under Jerry's leadership. Our teammates also give their time. In 2017, Bank of America teammates volunteered 2 million hours. And Jerry and I recognize the teammates that led the charge here in Naples early this morning. In this market, we did over 22,000 hours. We've also directed $1 million in support of the impact from Hurricane Irma in these communities. Now, just yesterday, Jerry made the calls to inject another $100,000 into four charities to help in the aftermath of the hurricane, because even though it's 6 months or so, the effects are still there. So that's what we do in sharing our success, volunteer, philanthropic work, and how in ESG. When we get to governance, it's how we conduct our business. Our independent board, and the two members are here today, our independent lead director, Jack Bovender, how we behave internally, it's all about driving the last part of being ESG and governance. The third tenet of being sustainable is to drive operational excellence. You hear a lot about long-term and short-term and how people make decisions. We have to continue to apply technology and simplification in our company to be able to invest in the future. By doing this operational excellence, we were able to invest $3 billion in technology code last year. Not running the systems, not processing pieces of paper, just ones and zeros going in the machines. We also were able to add 2,000 relationship people. We've refurbished 300 branches and opened 30 new ones. All this takes some real money, you know, and you have to invest. But in the world we're in, we have to generate that investment on our own. So that's the company, doing well, and how we're doing it is by driving responsible growth. So let's talk about the economy. We are proud to have the best research team in the business 6 out of 7 years. That's Bank of America Merrill Lynch, led by Candace Browning. That team just revised this morning their GDP for the United States from 2.7% in 2018 to 2.9%. The team has global GDP growing at 3.9% in 2018. For the global levels, that's a slight increase from 3.8% for 17 and 3% from 16. All that is driven by a stronger Europe, which is finally growing, a very strong India at 7.5%. And I was just in India the week before last with Prime Minister Modi, Finance Minister Jaitley, in bilateral meetings. They are interesting in that how the change are driving in that fundamentally huge population base to create a large economy to match it. And we have China growing 6% or so. For the U.S., we have GDP at 2.9%. That's up from 2.3% and 1.5% in 16. This, for the largest economy in the world, is quite strong. The U.S. consumer drives the U.S. economy. The simple way to think about it is the U.S. consumer economy is about equal to China's economy. So when people get really wound up about what's going on in China, you got to remember, if consumers quit spending in the United States, the world's not going to be pretty. So what does our data show us? We have the luxury of seeing about $2.5 trillion, about 10% of GDP, go through our consumers every year in payments, whether it's checks written, ATM, cash taken out, wires sent, debit and credit card usage, P2P payments, all the ways you interact with us. That payments for the first 10 weeks of this year is up 10% over last year. That's on about $600 billion spent already, to give you a sense. It's not a small sample. The year before, it was up about 6%. The year before, it was up 3%. So you can see the acceleration of consumer activity. Our proprietary small business surveys show strong confidence. So do the ones from the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the NFIB. Likewise, the BRT just released its survey the last week or so. All these companies are pushing forward, hiring, capital investment, and all of it looks solid. So conditions were solid last year. But with the tax reform this year and further deregulation, they are improving. A couple words on tax reform. We in the United States needed a tax rate that was competitive on a worldwide basis, and we needed a territorial system. And both those came through tax reform. We've seen the companies respond to that to be more competitive. We've seen U.S. companies pay bonuses to employees, increase 401k contributions, to make investments, repatriate cash, all the things you've been reading about in the paper. Importantly, we at Bank of America, like a lot of companies, took care of our teammates and let them share in the success of tax with $1,000 bonuses and likely scaled to teammates outside the United States to their compensation levels to 175,000 teammates. So American companies are enthusiastic about the tax changes. What surprised me in being in Davos in late January and in India last week is the international CEOs are even more excited about U.S. tax reform than the U.S. are. And you sort of said, why could that be true? It doesn't affect them. Well, it does. America's always had a great place to do things. We have great final demand, that big consumer base. We have a fundamental rule of law that actually sticks. Some of us question it from time to time, but generally sticks. We have a great workforce, great workforce flexibility, deep capital markets, and importantly, abundant and cheap energy on a relative basis, especially after the shale revolution. So with all that, the thing that could happen when foreign companies came to the United States to serve that demand is they could have two things. One is they paid a higher tax rate, that they might be willing to do, but they could trap income from all over the world into the United States tax system. That's why the territorial thing was important. They are incredibly enthusiastic, and you start to say, why would you come to the U.S. with a 2 or 3% growth rate when you're in India with a 7.5% growth rate? But it's all about that final demand and ability to serve it. So the consumer confidence is strong, and tax and deregulation provide some tailwinds. So being the risk managers that we're supposed to be, what could go wrong? Low inflation and slow rate rise remain very accommodative to growth. You heard Chairman Powell speak about this the other day. The projected increases in interest rates that you see, the dot plots or the market forward curves, show accommodations being taken away very slowly. But the rate structure will remain low, but there can be the fears that you see in spikes in inflation from time to time do move the markets around. You saw that a few weeks ago when the 10-year Treasury moved up. A trade war that is worried about, you saw affect the markets in the last couple days. We'll see what the long-term impacts are, is another risk. Market shock impacts caused by confidence in consumers. We don't see that yet, but if for some reason business quit employing and investing, you could see risk there. We predict unemployment to reach below 4% as we move towards year end. Tightening labor conditions could create inflationary impacts where the Fed would have to move faster due to wage increases. Again, not seen so far. And then the other risk, which is one that we can't control, but we have to learn how to manage around, which is the unexpected outcome of election risk. So as you go around the world and think about going all the way back to the Brexit vote, whether it was Brazil, whether it was Italy twice, whether it was France, whether it was the United States, all the pundits picked X and Y happened. And Y just wasn't another party winning. Y was a group that was going to change the way the country thought. And that creates volatility in markets and can create issues as they go through the transition of policies. But all in all, on the economy, 2.9% in the U.S., 3.9% around the world is a strong growth rate, and it's better this year than last year, which is always important. So let me touch on the third topic, and then we'll get to your questions. The third topic is transformation caused by technology. We've experienced massive changes in our company due to technology. Through the application of technology and capabilities, we've been able to combine, as an example, a high-touch, high-tech service model in our consumer business. We have 35 million digital customers at Bank of America today, 25 million mobile customers. Our digital activities represent 25% of our sales. Now, to put that in perspective, for banks, that's typically 7%, and for retail, that's 12%. So despite the impact of Amazon, 88% of sales still go through physical and retail, and so we're ahead of that. 23% of the checks deposited are by people taking pictures on their phones, and it's only been able to be done in the last 7 years. And the constant connectivity to our customers changes the business model dramatically. That phone is always on, and we're at the other end of it. But think about the impact on our shareholders. It's allowed us to reduce our headcount, our FTE count in our retail business by 40,000 people over a decade, from 100,000 to 60,000. We did that by releasing 1,500 branches. What goes through a mobile phone today is 1,000 branch equivalents of activity every day. And we've done it by, as we've increased the size of the business from $400 billion in deposits to $650 billion. But branches are incredibly important. And I get to hear from customers who want us to do better jobs and have more of them and everything every day. And we're expanding into cities we've never been in by opening branches. 800,000 people go into a Bank of America branch today. It's Friday, probably more, actually. And so we have to do a great job. So if you think about the impact of technology, let me give you another example, which is completely different. Before the word cloud was known in society, we started working on what we called an internal cloud. The idea was we had these server farms all over the place and 60 data centers, and people would apply, and we used about 20% of their capacity. By thinking about internal cloud, we've been able to move from 60 data centers to 20 data centers across 6 or 7 years and $1 billion of savings a year. So the impact of technology came from the ability to deliver those data centers when they're needed. That comes through the ability to move data fast, the ability to move computational activity fast, and it was really network availability that made that happen. So that's a different type of technology. So there's a couple examples, but what's ahead for us, and that's the thing I'd like to focus on. As I look ahead in technology, there's three or four trends that I think will interplay off each other, and none of them will be dominant, they'll all play off each other. First is voice recognition. You have Siri and Alexa, and all of you may be familiar with that. There's a new thing we call Erica, which is a Bank of America, is our a new capacity we're talking about, which is voice activated in our mobile banking platform. These voice activation, voice recognition capabilities are far more sophisticated than they've ever been and have a lot more to go to be effective. But they basically allow work to be caused by voice. If you think about it in a program where I can say, do this, and I don't have to key it in, I don't have to program it, and the computer can go off and program it, it's pretty neat. The second major trend is network capacity, distribution, and speed. We are still in the infancy of the amount of capacity we need these networks to do all the things that you hear about, driverless cars, et cetera. The next one is data storage, manipulation, and analytics. For an industry that deals with data, that's what it's all about. And the fourth, technology impact is robotics, artificial intelligence, and machine learning. So those all sound like great concepts, and we don't know where these ultimately go, but let me give you a couple ways we're applying them today. As I said, Erica is our new digital assistant. It's up with 40,000 teammates operating on it. I think we're rolling out the state of Rhode Island as we speak today. It allows you to talk and ask plain questions. What's my balance? And up comes your balance. What are my recurring payments? Up comes your recurring payments. Pay Brian $100, which you can all tell to do, and it will pay me $100. Through the artificial intelligence embedded in it, it starts to anticipate what you ask. We get asked 5 to 6 million times a month at the call center, what's the routing number for Bank of America? That is not unique. It's the same routing number we've had since we had the charter, probably. It's not proprietary, it's not unique, it's not unique to anything. By having Erica answer the question, we can save 5 million calls a month. And just think about the efficiency. So when you go into Erica, it says, do you want your routing number? And you press it and it pops the routing number. To make it work, think about what has to happen. 25 million mobile phone customers at any instant could pick that up, press that button, need to interface with us perfectly, need to have the ability to recognize their voice, need to be able to turn that into artificial intelligence, need to be able to find the data in their account, and need to be able to send it back to them without any what we call latency, without any delay. And that's where these technologies start to work together. I'll give you another example. We have an auto buying service that we just have rolled out across the country. In it are 2,000 dealers' real-time inventory, up-to-date inventory. 1 million cars available. So you can shop for a car. You want a Toyota Corolla, it's red, blah, 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 and the zip code, it'll pop up that car. And at the same time, you can load and get a loan. So when you walk in the dealer, you're done. That technology allows this to happen because of, obviously, the underwriting is all automated. But on the other hand, think about the connectivity to 2,000 dealers and a million cars at any given moment. We don't know where the customer lives when he or she picks up the phone. What we do know is when they punch in that zip code, we got to be ready to reserve them. So that's the way this technology comes together. 7 times the application volume just in the places it's been out for a couple of quarters. Another example is a thing we call Zelle. You're reading more about this. Zelle is P2P payments. The banking industry created this as a group to allow payments between banks with nothing but your email address or your cell phone. So what allows that to happen is you can basically say, as I said, you can say, pay Brian, or if you go into your mobile app and you hit send money to someone, and all you have to have is their cell phone, and the other bank will have the money come in real time. And in the quarter, this quarter, we'll have 25 million Zelle transactions growing 125% per year. Another example on the different side is a robot that automatically fills in the corporate information in our AML KYC area and a money laundering know your customer area. It goes out, pulls down the 10K, finds out all the information about the company, preloads a form, and it's doing this. For about a $400,000 or $500,000 investment, it's 14 human being equivalents worth of work. One-time investment versus an annual 14 people. So these technologies are going to come together. We don't know where they're going to take us. The impact is uncertain. But it's going to take mastery of all of them, some experimentation, and go back to operational excellence, the ability to keep investing in them far before they'll have a meaningful impact on the company. And it also creates societal implications. How do you retrain employees given that you're going to be needing less of them? And then how do you have a set of morals or ethics or values built into the machine so it'll turn itself off when certain things happen? And these are the interesting questions we're going to get into over time here in society. So let me close before taking questions and just hit a couple points. Our company is doing well. It's a great company and teammates do a great job. But the thing I'm most proud of every day is how they serve our purpose. They are here to make your lives better and they do a great job of it. The priority for us is to stick to our approach of driving responsible growth. We're well positioned for the future, great market position, great capabilities, great capital, great balance sheet, etc. But it's only because of driving responsible growth we'll have that in good and bad times. We're working in an area where the economy in the U.S. is strong and getting stronger, and around the world we're seeing the same thing. We're doing well. We're doing the best we've ever done. Technology ahead of us will make this business incredibly interesting over the next decade and beyond. But take one thing home with you today. We never forget how we do it. We're only here to serve you, and that's what we do. We wouldn't be successful without you as our customers and clients. Thank you, and now let me take questions.
Thank you, Brian. It's a Forum Club tradition to present you with these beautiful picture books about Marco Island and Naples.
So okay. Thank you.
I'll keep those for you under the podium for later, but that's so you don't forget the time you spent here. So we had a record number of questions. I can't ever remember having this many before, so I sorted through them quickly and picked up some recurring themes. The first one that came up a lot is, are you seeing any early warning signs of a recession?
Not in a technical sense. So, you know, the market every day, you know, it went down the last couple of days. Oh, my God, the recession's here. But if you think about how the economy is structured with the unemployment level staying down, new claims for unemployment, if you watch that number, it's at an all-time low. And if you think about it, it's like 220,000, a four-week average, maybe 230,000. Since the last time I was at this level, America's 30 or 40% bigger. So it's way down low. And that's what you'd start to see. So when we saw the emergence of the crisis in the late 2000s, what you saw was that number got ahead, and that's a leading indicator. When companies are letting people go or they're laying them off and they're filing for unemployment, and that shoots up, that's way down. So unemployment's down, that's down. Job formation is still strong. So in the end of the day, if companies are employing people and paying them and they're spending, the cycle of the economy works. So we don't see it yet. We worry about it. Every economist will tell you next year's chance of recession is 30%. They said that last year. They said that the year before. They said it the year before. They said it the year before. They said it the year before. Sometimes they take it down to 20%. It's just something could go wrong in some of those Pareto horribles I talked about and cause it. But there's nothing you see fundamental today. And so we'll see what happens. But we don't see it, and our experts really don't see it. So.
Great. Thank you. We had several questions about information protection, data security, given the headlines recently. Can you talk about what Bank of America is doing about that?
Sure. Well, if you think about the impact of those technologies, and then you think about what would happen if people lost faith in the ability to transact with us through digital, mobile, et cetera. We need 1,000 branches like tomorrow. We need 10,000, 30,000 people, 20,000 people in those branches like tomorrow. You know, and so we take this very seriously. So, you know, from when I became CEO in 2010, we were probably spending about $200 million, and that was probably more than anybody else was spending at the time. We now spend about $600 million. So even as we brought the cost down the company from $70 billion to $50 billion, that number's gone up purely on data security and, you know, cybersecurity. And so we do a good job. The industry has gotten together and does some stuff, especially the biggest banks that we help the other banks on threat detection and threat awareness. And so the industry is considered, and we were just with the Homeland Security in Washington the day before, you guys are the best and you do the best job. Your industry does it. And so we do a pretty good job. The question is, it's always, where's the weak link? What could happen? And that's the case of the Experian dump or things like that. So when Target let the data be compromised, it cost us $30 million to replace everybody's card. So we're coming up with ways that will mitigate the impact of losing your data. For example, one of the things that I think is coming out soon is, you know, if you're a parent and have kids at school and stuff, you used to give them your credit card or give them a thing, and then when they lost the credit card, you had to replace yours. Now we have different, one account, but multiple card numbers, so when they lose theirs, we just kill theirs and you don't have to keep going through. That saves us money. If there's four cards on an account, we had to replace four cards. Now we only have to replace the one that was lost, and, you know, it's $5 a card, so it happens. So there's all these ways, but also protect the data better by not having so many numbers out. The Zelle product, the encryption in the chip card, you know, all these things. So we're very intense about it from cybersecurity and the risk there. Data protection and how we use your data, we are very clear with it. We don't really use it for anything but what we need it for. And that's, you know, after Facebook, that becomes the issue. And then we're trying to pick up and drive the capabilities of people to protect their data. And we also want, a little bit was talked about in the last 48 hours or so, people who store data, like a retailer storing transactional data, ought to be held the same standards that we're held to, because that data causes just as much damage. There's no rule or regulation about regulating those people. And so they can store the data that we store for the purposes of figuring out what you bought and what you're going to do next time, loyalty programs, whatever. And they've got to start regulating just to get them to either only store the data they need. And that's a narrow set versus all the stuff they store. So it's a tough issue. We keep spending money, and we do a pretty good job. So,
thank you. There were several questions about various disruptors to traditional financial services firms, i.e. Amazon getting into banking.
Well, sometimes be careful what you wish for. I think we always had the concern whether Walmart would get into banking in the sense that their profit margins were 5%. So Ken, when he was CEO, he used to go out and see him. We always said, if they come in, you know, with the amount of customers and their profit margin, they could actually, the problem is you need the capital and the balance sheet and other things to do it. And I think they learned over the years that this wasn't the way to do it. So we worked closely with them to help them deliver products and services. I think Amazon, what they're really announcing is more of that, using, you know, ways that they can get people to spend more by using partners to drive it. And that's what they're after. So, you know, we worry about losing control of the payment system as an industry, a competitive base, but also as a safety basis. You've seen a lot of lending ideas come up and come and go, and they'll come up and come and go, and that will happen. It's not new. It's just done differently. But the real disruption you worry about is around the payment industry, because the payment business is what makes banks unique. And for that, we have a lot of rules, regulations, capital. And we've got to make sure that people don't keep chipping away at that and leave us with the least attractive parts of it, and that's probably the biggest risk for us. And then you have on the advice side, the robo-advisor and the independents and all that stuff, and passive investing and trends that people continue to drive through. And you have, you know, other aspects and automation in the markets business that drives down revenues and profit. But these are not new themes, and our job is just to disrupt ourselves rather than wait to be disrupted.
Thank you. There were also several questions around the topic of corporate social activism and some societal issues, so most recently the issue around guns.
Right.
Talk about how we think about that.
Well, we try to think through these issues from all different aspects, and so what we have is we have a group that works with Ann Finucane as our vice chair, and they look at the issues and come back with recommendations that we made on things like coal and things, and so we are now looking at guns in the same way. So we went out and told people, we're asking the gun manufacturers on the assault side, what are you going to do to fix this? And you need to fix it. And if you don't fix it, we didn't say what would happen, but you can assume, you can guess at what we would do. You saw City yesterday announced some stuff. There's certain things we can't do. We don't know when somebody goes into Dick's what they actually buy. We just know they spent $200. And so that was a wrong-headed column saying, unless they change the rules and we're allowed to see what they buy, which I don't think people want us to see. You know, the way for us to control this is ultimately the manufacturers. And not get into the whole, you know, recreational stuff, but the question of assault rifles, you know, and this state obviously had a major tragedy, you know, a few weeks ago, and you keep seeing this happen way too many times. And we have teammates involved in every one of these. Las Vegas, we had 5 people that lost relatives. All the way back to Charleston, half the people related to teammates. So we get involved in this on a very emotional basis, like all of you. And we think these people have to solve the problem by civilians and assault rifles. They got to fix the question. And if they can, then we can do business. When they can't, we have to think it through. And that's not shotguns and all the other stuff that goes on. There's really a narrow question here, and I think you'll see some activity. But how we decide is we have to balance, because if you split the room here, you might have 2 different opinions on all this stuff. That is our customer base. That is our employee base. And so, you know, we don't take political positions. We took it on HB1 in North Carolina because it was hurting our economy and hurting our company. That was different. That was our hometown. Other places we try to say, how do we make the thing move to where we think it's right, but do it in a way that doesn't create ramifications beyond what the question of the moment is. So you'll see, I think, the industry continue to push on this issue to get people to focus on it. We'll see what happens.
Here's an interesting one. Is Mr. Buffett hands off?
I would tell you that when I see people who are looking for strategic investors, I ask them that they should go see Warren. Warren Buffett called me at 10 o'clock in the morning, and by 8 o'clock the next morning, he'd invested $5 billion in a company. I'd never met him other than, you know, he called and said, Brian, I want to put $5 billion. You need some stability. You're getting knocked around. It's not right. You guys are doing a great job. You're doing the right things. And I said, Warren, we don't need the money. And he said, I wouldn't call you if you needed the money. And so if you bought common stock that day, you actually fared better than he did. You just had to have the courage to do it. And a lot of big investors came and said, I want a part of that deal. He said, the deal was in the market. Our preferreds are trading at 9%. He got 6%. You could buy our common for $5 and change, and he bought it for $7. So you could get that deal. It's just that when people said, why didn't you have me come in part of the deal? I said, A, you're not Warren Buffett, and even though you're a great investor, I don't think when you invest in this, I'm going to have 230,000 teammates go back to work the next day and say the best investor in the world thinks we are a great company. And so it was, and he is a great investor in that there's only 50 employees at Berkshire Hathaway. The management's run him. He's a, you know, in our case especially, because he's 7% and we're regulated. The last thing he wants to do is get past a point. So I talk to him from time to time. He's been a great supporter. He comes and talks to our team on occasion, but he knows what we're doing, he understands what we're doing, and he likes it, so he's got better things to spend his time on, I think.
Brian, so I think everyone knows you're involved in a leadership role with the World Economic Forum and spent some time in Davos in January. We had a couple of questions about repatriation of foreign assets. How's that going to affect the European financial system, and how does the U.S. financial system benefit?
Well, when you go through the business reviews, the lenders in our company are saying, oh, everybody's bringing back this money and paying off a lot of debt. And I said, nobody's brought back that much money yet, so stop. You're just excused. But the reality is people are going to bring back money because the two pieces. Importantly, the territorial system protects more money from going off for pure tax planning purposes. And so the free flow of funds, it used to be that you had to pay 30-odd percent to get it back, and now you don't. And then the old money, so to speak, you're taxed on it already, so you already paid the tax. So we had a charge in the fourth quarter, like a lot of people did. Part of that charge was to pay the tax. So the money, you've already paid the tax, you might as well get it back here and get it to work if it makes sense in your capital structure. So I think you'll see that start to happen. App obviously announced some very huge things that maybe only they can do, but you're seeing more subtly, you're seeing more stuff come back, and you'll see that being invested back to the same principle I talked about earlier. So pay attention. It's just hard. People didn't expect tax reform. We were told tax reform was going to pass for 6 out of 8 years before it passed, with bipartisan senior senators that ought to know better than to promise something they can't deliver on, sitting in front of the business roundtable and other groups saying, we've got the deal worked out, and then the administration, the Treasury Secretary, it never happened. So the fact that it happened surprised the heck out of people. And we're all sort of from Missouri up to the very end. So the idea that only 2 months and a half later that people haven't made massive changes, their business model is completely understandable. So I think as time rolls on, you'll see more activity. But so far, you're seeing some announcements, and they'll all be good. The opposite is the money just stays out there. There's no reason for it to come back to the United States. You can find final demand. You can sell your products. You can access the whole chain of development, whether it's raw materials, IP, production, et cetera, sales. You don't need to bring the money back to the United States. That's the difference between now and the Clinton years when they talked about, well, we got our pockets paid. The world's changed dramatically. There's enough final demand outside the United States that the money can be put to work for profit out there. Used to be you made the money outside the United States and you really just couldn't invest it fast enough. You can now. And so that's the wisdom of going to territorial now, is it'll use that issue and you'll stop the inversions and other things.
So, Brian, related to that, there were several questions about how you intend to spend or invest the corporate tax savings.
Well, we told people on the call in January, and it was still early days, that we're going to do some stuff to the employees, which we did. So there's about a $200 million investment in the bonuses I talked about. There was another share grant to another bracket up. So everybody but the top 8% got a benefit. And so that's about $250 million. And then we'll step up investment. So you heard us talk about some of the work we're doing in branches and places we aren't, and we're going to do that a little faster, and we're going to invest some more in technology. It'll be modest, and that's what I said to people. And people say, why don't you do more? It's the reality is you can only get so much done. Every weekend we have a major million-plus lines of code go into our technology platform, and there's only so much you can do before you screw it up. So we're doing $3 billion. The highest I think we ever did was about $3.7 billion, and that was in a merger context where the work was more defined. So, we'll spend a chunk, but it will be relatively immaterial. The rest will come to the bottom line and ultimately go back to shareholders as capital. And if we have something better to do, we'll tell the shareholders and do it. But right now, there's only so fast you can find real estate for branches. There's only so fast you can do the technology. So it's a chance. And so we're going to invest as much as was wise, send the rest back. Somebody else will invest it. That's the mistake people think. There's nothing wrong with the money going back to the market because it has to go somewhere. It'll find its way to someone who needs capital more than we do at this point.
Brian, the last question comes from a student, and thanks for the great questions. They're asking about advice for young people. What skills do you think will be needed in the future economy?
There will be a lot of discussion about STEM skills and things like that. So you do need to have basic math and analytical skills. But for the number one thing is just remain curious and keep learning. The mistake, we all get dumber the day we leave the college campus if you don't go on to college. It's just because you're just think of the amount of information that comes at you every day. Unless you maintain an intensity to follow it and learn from it, read and absorb, whether it's newspapers, whether it's be a little more careful about curating of what you're reading now for young people, because a lot of it is crazy. But just keep reading, just keep learning. And I think any skills will be applicable. If you think about understanding what consumers are doing, that takes psychology and sociology and data analytics and mathematics and engineering to make it happen. All of them are possible, but you can do it a lot of different ways. And so I think the mistake people make is I had this skill. If someone said they want to be an emergency room doctor, that's a skill set you're going to have to go, the first young lady. You're going to have to go to medical school. You're going to have to do that. That's understandable. But to do the work in a company like ours or other companies, you need to have a basic understanding of math and accounting and things like that. What you really have to do is just be curious and smart. and that you could pursue anything.
Great. Brian, thanks so much for being with us today. It's been delightful.
Thank you.